I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio. And today we're going to be talking about something that, depending on the day of the week in the community that you live in, a lot of Wednesdays, I think, we're going to be talking about the food sections of newspapers or food pages, or as they used to be called, the women's pages. And, you know, they've been around in newspapers, I guess, probably over 100 years. And we're often overlooked, really, as nothing more than a collection of recipes or culinary advice akin to the Dear Abby columns. Not such a bad thing. And in the 70s, Gloria Steinem even called to have them banned from the pages as ghettos for women. Well, look back over some of those food pages, and you'll find some very interesting information. However, we tend to know the names of a few standouts, like I'm sure everyone recognizes the name Craig Claiborne, but do you know the name Jane Nickerson or Dorothy Crandall? My guest today is Kim Voss, and Kim is a associate professor and coordinator of journalism at the University of Central Florida, and she has spent a lot of time both for her PhD dissertation and in writing a book, a recent book we're going to be talking about called The Food Section. She's been spent a lot of time exploring these writers and actually the art of food journalism and what it was, particularly after World War II, I would say. As she says, this book clarifies what newspaper food journalism was and the information that's in them. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, it's interesting because we communicated earlier and you had done a paper, or I guess maybe it wasn't your dissertation, maybe it was a theme of a conference paper, which you called Food Journalism or Culinary Anthropology, which I absolutely love because I think it really spells out a lot of what we're talking about today.
I agree. The term actually came from Jean Volz, which is how she described herself as a culinary anthropologist in her role as a food editor.
Interesting. And she is one of those women behind the scenes. And your book, The Food Pages, The Food Section, Women, I don't have this written in front of me. Here it is. The Food Section, Newspaper Women and the Culinary Community is the full title. And you really do explore some of these women from the early days. My question to you is, what do the food pages in newspapers tell us about culinary history?
The food sections of the 1950s and the 1960s show that we had a more complex relationship with food than I think had previously been described. One of the terms that was tossed about was jello abuse, that there was lots of convenience food for the times, and there certainly was some of that. But you see reviews of cookbooks with international dishes well before we see Julia Child appear. You see us falling in and out of love with baking bread. You see trends going in and out of style, although I would say the one thing that always remained was a love of bacon.
Yeah.
and we've always tried to find ways to cut corners in cooking, as well as what the women often called weekend meals, which would have been things that you could spend some time on. But there's always been kind of a mix of that, of people who are trying to do it quickly, as well as a love of making something from scratch.
Right. Well, it's interesting because I picked up an old article. Oh, it was even prior to the 50s. It was right before World War II, and so it was kind of like post-Depression era. And you talked about cutting corners. It was all about, you know, how to be a good homemaker, how to, you know, feed your family a nutritious meal, and how to create something, you said the weekend meals, how to create something elegant and special out of very little. So
right.
it's nothing, I mean, that's always nothing new. That's the advice column. That's the advice that women needed, right?
Oh, exactly. And it was also a connection to the readers in the community who may have felt alone or not known what to do in these situations. It really was a true community that these food editors created. They were often local celebrities in their cities or towns.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, you pointed out in your book that you were kind of clarifying the newspaper journalism and how this media differs from, let's say, the food writing in the glossies, the magazines. Explain a little bit how you feel this difference plays out in the two forms.
Sure. What you see with magazines, of course, they're national, so they don't have the same kind of connection to the local reader. So food editors would explain that maybe a home cook would read about something in a magazine, not really know how to do it, and call your food editor. Right, that was your hyper-local conversation. In addition was the role of advertising. At magazines, there's kind of a blurred line between advertising often and the editorial side. Whereas at newspapers, that's usually a very strict line. Advertising does not impact the editorial side. And that's a pretty large wall. You don't break that. And so what I wanted to see if that was truly the same with food, because that had been the accusation, that these food editors were easily swayed by their local grocery store, by national advertisers, that they could be easily manipulated. And I wanted to see if that was true, because I knew that that wasn't true for the women's page in general. The women's pages operated just the same way that the other sections of your politicals, your editorial side, your sports. And so I thought it was kind of strange that food, for whatever reason, would have been held to the same standard. And so when I began looking at it, it was true. These women had high ethical standards. They were not easily swayed. They explained that if an advertiser kind of tried to force a recipe on them, it would go right in the garbage can, and that they had themselves had to fire some food writers who had taken freebies from advertising companies. So clearly there was a very different relationship when it came to the role of advertisers in the newspaper food section versus, say, maybe a food magazine.
Interesting. So the moniker Jell-O abuse for those pages was clearly wrong because, I mean, obviously the food pages became even more important and more widespread during the time of fast food coming up, you know, canned goods, frozen foods.
Right.
So there obviously instruction for women on how and home cooks on how to use it, but. and Jell-O, I guess you had to find different ways to use Jell-O, but certainly Jell-O, not in the term of taking it, you know, having to push the product, right?
Right.
Interesting. Well, who were, you know, food editors at that time were primarily dominated by women, was it not?
Yes, I only found two men that were food editors versus, say, 125 to 150 food editors that attended the annual meeting. So, I mean, this was clearly women's work. And again, it was in the women's pages where that was pretty much the only place women could work at newspapers up until the late 60s and early 1970s. So it was kind of natural that it would have come out that women would be writing this. Many of the editors had home economics journalism majors, which was a very popular major, actually, at the time. And, of course, these home economics programs were producing women that were going into the workforce at universities, at high schools. So home economics was a very viable career for women in the 50s and 60s that we don't often kind of talk about. So they had this background that they were bringing as journalists, but as kind of specialists in that area.
Yeah. Well, when you consider the fact that a lot of recipes had to be tested before they could print them in the newspaper, and that certainly makes sense.
Oh, yes. And several newspapers had test kitchens. Other food editors would actually test it in their homes. And another newspaper would ask reporters to test the recipes if they happened to be cooks, and they'd be reimbursed, you know, for the ingredients. Mm-hmm. But the top newspapers did test all their recipes, other than the ones that came through the wires, because those were assumed to be have tested then. It's worth mentioning that these food sections at this time could be up to 60 or 70 pages, just the food section.
Wow.
In that post kind of World War II consumer era where you had all this advertising to fill it, and particularly, say, during the holidays, Christmas and Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because now, I mean, I guess maybe because there are the proliferation of so many glossy magazines back in the, you know, in the 80s and 90s. Of course, now it's all about the Internet. That
right.
At times these food sections have become so slim, I mean, they barely exist.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, and so that kind of explains, too, how much work these women had to do to put up, the, you know, because this was a time when you were setting it by hand. You didn't have computers and you were actually typing. And so, you know, it was a very big job to put out these things. In addition to putting out their food sections, almost all the food editors wrote cookbooks, cooking pamphlets, held cooking contests, judged contests, in later years traveled internationally quite a bit. Because, of course, if you're going to say a dish tastes like authentic Italian cooking, you have to go to Italy.
Uh-huh.
So these women, you know, really did have quite exciting and interesting careers that I think they were allowed to do that because it was in this women's section which didn't seem so threatening. So that, you know, this writing about food allowed them to do all sorts of other things. And what's, I think, different about food journalism versus other beats of the newspaper is many of these food editors stayed at the same newspaper for decades, 40, 50 years. You know, they knew the next generation of cooks from families. They really did know their community very, very well.
Wow. And, of course, then we had syndication. So some of their columns were syndicated in other papers as well, right?
Oh, yes. The Chicago Tribune, the food editor there was a woman by the name of Ruth Ellen Church, who often wrote under the name Mary Mead. And she was quite well known for kind of finding people. She had a column that she had syndicated, Cooking for Men, at a time when we kind of didn't expect that necessarily to be grilling, maybe, but not cooking. And that was Morrison Wood. And there were all these kind of syndications where they connected to each other, too. The women often would speak not only at the cooking competitions, but on the phone, and they would write about it in their sections, how they talked to so-and-so from across the country that was at another newspaper.
Mm. Well, you mentioned food contests, cooking competitions, and
yes.
Of course that was also a big draw to get these women to, you know, to read the food sections, too. They were big across the country. They were so big. I mean, it was a fun thing, and there were prizes often. Now, how did they separate that editorial from advertising when, let's say, Pillsbury sponsored it?
Sure. Well, it's kind of two different ways. The first is for their own personal contest, excuse me, they saw that as a service versus advertising. So in other words, that's how you would almost kind of in a publicity standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And the women who won these contests, it was often a very big deal. I found obituaries where stay-at-home women, that was their big deal, you know, that back in 1965, that their local newspaper had said they were the best cook on the block. I mean, it really mattered. So it was kind of a service in that way. When it came to things like the Pillsbury Bake Off, which, of course, you know, when they were giving away $1 million, that's news. But, for example, the Louisville newspaper, they refused to call it the Pillsbury Bake Off. It was just a national bake off.
Huh.
They kind of found their way around that. In Milwaukee, the food editor was allowed to go as long as there were local finalists. That was kind of how they, and they would pay the airfare, you know, so to make sure that they weren't kind of taking too much from Pillsbury. But it was another kind of networking way for these women to get together.
Right. Well, that was basically through the 70s. I can see what Gloria Steinem meant when she wanted to have the pages banned because she called them, you know, women's ghettos. Because, as you said, if this was the only place where women could write for a newspaper, then indeed we should, you know, get rid of those and send these women out to write in other fields. But this was their specialty, especially if they had home economics, food journalism backgrounds. I mean, that was, you know, what happened? All of a sudden, the men came in. What happened there?
Well, in Gloria Steinem's defense about two or three years later, she did admit that maybe she had misstated that, that that actually may have been an empowering place for women. But by that time, it was really too late. A bunch of things kind of happened at the same time to erase the food sections in the way they had been. One was the call for the end of the women's pages, and so they turned into what we now see as style or lifestyle kinds of publications. The food section kind of spun out on itself then in the 1970s. We also saw the end of the home economics dominance. Programs across the country by the early 1970s had gotten rid of it in the way that it had once been, and they would even change its names. I think at one point there was like two dozen variations of what once had been home ec, as schools kind of tried to distance themselves if they could.
Technical science and industry or something. It was anything but home ec.
Right, anything but home ec, you know. And so all those things kind of happened, and as you mentioned, in the theory, the hope was that women then, if we put men in the food section and men in the style section, that women would get to cover politics and sports and all those areas that had been denied them. And it didn't really happen that way. You know, some women got to do some things, but for many of them, you know, they were still covering soft news. And historians don't tend to like to look at soft news, the food, the fashion, the feature stories. They like front page. They like covering war, you know, those kinds of things where women are in men's space in that way. And so all of those things kind of happened. And you'd mentioned Jane Nickerson earlier, and I think in part it has been this almost echo chamber discussion of James Beard and Craig Claiborne, right, all these men. Because Jane Nickerson, when she left, she was at the New York Times as their first food editor from 1942 to 1957. And many papers said she retired, and she didn't. She came down to Lakeland, Florida, and raised her four children. By 1973, she's a food editor at the Lakeland Ledger, and she's already written a cookbook. But she was, I'd say, a humble person, unlike someone like Craig Claiborne, who was a self-promoter. Mm-hmm. And so see her kind of marginalized. But she was the first one to write about James Beard. She was the first one to write about Craig Claiborne. If you consider the food development that happened post-World War II, or even the rationing of the war, what Jane was doing is inherently important. As she wrote about, you know, all sorts of big chefs at fancy restaurants, as well as local home cooks.
Right, they would because they would also be reviewing restaurants in their local neighborhoods, right?
Yes. Yeah, in fact, she and her future husband, as well as James Beard and Cicely Brownstone, who had been the longtime food editor for the Associated Press, the four of them would often go out to eat together. And key, in many ways, to telling the story had been that Cicely Brownstone did an oral history. That's at the Fales Library at NYU. And she really clarified a lot of this and kind of made sure that I knew I was going down the right path as I read her oral history about New York food and about Jane.
Right. Well, and I think that was conducted by Laura Shapiro, right?
Yes,
Laura's been a guest on the show. And, of course, she writes so much about or has written so much about food journalism and the early people. And she, too, I mean, she says she uses those food pages when she does culinary history, when she looks, you know, and you look at history of things. And the contributions to culinary history, to the food world, from these pages, is immeasurable, really.
It really was, and I guess I was kind of surprised as I began to look at this that no one had went and looked at the sections. I mean, no one really had taken apart what was there and who these women were, what they had accomplished. And so they were, you know, I got up to more than 60 women when I published the book. I'm now near 80, and they were all really good stories. I mean, they made my job very easy.
Well, I want to talk about some of these specific women that you explored when we come back after a short break, so stay tuned.
You are listening to New Ease by Mama Ratsy.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Okay, and we're back talking with Kim Voss about the food section of your local newspaper. Sounds like an advertisement right there. And even though a lot of the food pages are online today and you can get them a day in advance or 2 days in advance, I still just love getting that for us. It's in the New York Times. It's the Wednesday section. I just love getting that section and pouring over it. It doesn't take too much time anymore because, as I say, it diminished to a few pages, but then they're always continued online. They expand, you know, the expanded version is always online. But there's just something special about holding that special section and knowing that I'm going to find something of interest that I can apply to, you know, to my daily life. And you talked about, Kim, about some of these journalists and their contributions, one of them being introducing ethnic foods.
Yes.
So what there is an interesting story, and I think we're talking about the story of curry.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Sure. We've made broad generalizations about food, particularly in the 50s and 60s. And so for a long time, the theory was that we had more international dishes being cooked because men had gone to war and tried these various dishes and came home and asked their wives or mothers to cook for them. But Nora Ephron, in writing about food, said that maybe it was the introduction of curry. That was the changing point in our American dishes trying our new palate, new ideas. And Cicely Brownstone was the one that had kind of first written about curry. She wrote for the Associated Press, and so her columns went across the country. And she was a real champion of curry when it was, and kind of normalized it for American meals.
Huh, interesting. I can still see recipes cut out from the food section in my mother's old cookbooks and even in my old cookbooks from way back when. And it would be, you know, there'd be that Chinese recipe or, you know, a recipe for some Asian flavored dish or Hungarian dish. And then, in fact, of course, you said Craig Claiborne was a great self-promoter, but he published the international cookbooks, you know, from collected recipes that he published in the New York Times. And they were all very good recipes, and they spanned the globe. It was interesting. But these women were doing it all along. So let's talk about some of these women in particular. Cecily Brownstone, of course, you've mentioned. And I mentioned Dorothy Crandall up front. She wrote for the Boston Globe, right? So give me some of the ones you found who had very maybe interesting lives or had made a poignant discovery or contribution.
Well, I think you mentioned Dorothy Crandall, and the comment that always kind of came up about her was she was well known for the recipe she shared with her readers, where you cooked a roast under the your car as you drove. It would cook next to the engine, and that was not actually an uncommon thing to do. Innovative, strange ways of cooking food.
I was going to open the show with that, saying, "You've all heard the story about cooking a roast on your engine, but I bet you don't know who wrote it, right?"
Right. There was the food editor in Denver who had put introduced a recipe having to do with cooking with bourbon. She was going to have a dish with chicken, and all of a sudden she got all these phone calls that this dish had exploded out of the their ovens. Of course, it's high altitude cooking, so I make some things different. But no one could figure out why this chicken dish was exploding. So their lawyers were concerned, of course. So they had some food economists come out and test. And what happened was these home cooks were doubling the amount of bourbon and then putting foil around it. So they were basically creating little bombs that were going off. So her whole career, she was kind of known for the exploding chicken recipe that she had. Ruth Ellen Church, as I mentioned, from the Chicago Tribune, who was there nearly five decades, was the first newspaper wine editor.
I mean, that's almost unheard of.
Yes.
It's amazing.
And she got to, again, travel quite a bit abroad to write about wines. And really was kind of the first one to kind of normalize something and make it less exotic and something that was more approachable for Americans. Mm-hmm. Jean Volz, as I mentioned earlier, who was really the very first champion of barbecue. And we take that for granted now because we have shows and all sorts of cookbooks and it's very kind of elevated form, particularly to talk about Southern cooking. But when Jean wrote about it, you know, you didn't write about barbecue. Because you know French food and European food were kind of the standards, but
everyone was supposed to know how to barbecue, right?
Yes, right. And you know, as Jean had spoke about it later, she just thought that was a good story that no one had told. Hmm. You know, at the heart, many of these women were journalists. In fact, the food editor that was in Minnesota had mentioned that she loved being a journalist, so she loved her early stories when she burned things or things didn't work out, because it's a better narrative than, right, the food that turns out well. And so 30 years later, she was a very accomplished cook, and her readers would say, we miss the old days. We miss when you made mistakes. It was entertaining to read that way. and many of them were actually very poor cooks. The food editor at the St. Petersburg Times, colleagues had told me that she was just a horrible cook. They hated when she brought food in for potlucks and that sort of thing. And some of these journalists didn't want to be considered to be cooks in the same way that the Milwaukee editor had mentioned. You don't expect a court reporter who's covering the court system to go out and commit crimes to write about it.
Right.
You don't expect your sports reporter to be a great athlete. And so some of these women were actually quite insulted if they were asked if they were cooks because their expertise, so just their beats, you know, the journalism. And I'd say probably one of my favorites was Peggy Dahm, who was a longtime food editor at the Milwaukee Journal. And it was because of Peggy that the Association of Food Journalists was created. As I mentioned earlier, there were annual meetings that these women would meet up at. There was a chance for politicians to speak, for food advertisers to show their new, you know, the new products, the new trends of the year, you know, that sort of thing. In 1971, Senator Frank Moss showed up at the meeting. And again, government officials often did. It wasn't unheard of. But he was a big consumer advocate. And he actually called these women to their faces whores of the supermarket.
Huh.
And, you know, for this idea that they were being manipulated. And so later that night, it was in Chicago, and in Peggy Dahm's Chicago hotel room, all these food editors got together and claimed that they would never have this happen to them again. And so a couple years later, they did have their own organization. They had their own speakers, and they had their own food contests, writing contests, and that sort of thing. And Peggy was their first president. And so it was easy to study the Milwaukee Journal because those are all on Google News, which made it a little bit easier, too. But she had a master's degree in journalism. She'd had an undergrad in home economics journalism and wrote two cookbooks. You know, she's kind of very symbolic of many of the women that I came across.
Right. Well, there did come that period in the 70s, where I mentioned Gloria Steinem, that, you know, that whole, and you even have a chapter devoted to the changes in food and feminism and the demise of home cooking. What did we see with the food pages when around that time?
Well, sure. What you kind of throughout the 60s, you really did see some change in, you saw more nutrition news. I remember there's one story that explained how the reader would say the word cholesterol. You know, it was kind of that new, the understanding of health and that sort of thing. And so part of what happens with the loss of women's pages and spitting out of the food section in the 70s is that you also saw more consumer news that was covering food. So some of the things that had been in the women's section was now in the consumer. And again, you saw these women's pages that had really been great advocates for their communities go away. And I think that was a real mistake for many newspapers because there was a real connection between these women's sections and their readership. Most, in fact, all newspapers that I came across had recipe exchange columns. So the idea would be if you lost grandma's recipe for, you know, a key lime pie, mm-hmm. if you went to a restaurant and tried something, there would be a column in the newspaper, in the food section, that would help you find that. And it's often what you kind of think of today as crowdsourcing. Often it would be the food editor would put the question out there, and readers would send things in. And so it was a real close relationship. And at many newspapers, they had a whole economic staff that would look up recipes. You know, before we had Google to help us find recipes, a home cook would call into her newspaper and say, I would like a recipe for this. And it would be found, copied, and mailed out to her. You know, that kind of relationship was really what the women's pages in large part were about. And so I think getting rid of that section really helped change the relationship between women, in particular women readers, and their newspapers. You know, there used to be a saying that there was three times a good woman had her name in the paper: when you got born, you got married, and when you died. And I often found in my reading there was a fourth time that a woman's name should be in the newspaper, and that's when she was cited as a good cook.
Interesting. I like that community feeling that the newspaper food sections gave, that they were very community oriented. I think less so we see today. In fact, that's what right. I wanted to ask you is what do you see as some of the major differences in the newspaper food sections today, and where do you think they're headed?
Well, I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, they're much smaller. And there's a lot less room. I mean, there is online digital content, of course, but it does make me feel sad to see how small those print sections have gotten, particularly because they once were so thick. And it's worth noting that all that advertising that went into that food section didn't go back to that food editor. That was monies and revenue that went to help the rest of the newspaper do the things that they wanted to do. I do think that traditional food editors at newspapers still have quite a lot of power. You know, they have a following on social media, they have a following online, people know their names in the same sort of way that they did back in the day. So I do think there is a sense of that. I certainly hope that newspapers respect that, the connection to the food editor, because there really is something there. I do a lot of talks throughout Florida about my book, and in every audience, I have a collection of people that want to talk about their food editor, that they, as you mentioned, they've clipped those coupons. They know them so well. And so as we see more of an interest in food, I'd say more recently, I hope that the food editors continue to be part of that conversation.
Right. Well, and the writing, I think I have seen definitely an improvement in the quality of the writing. And it was a male food journalist who actually had once spoken to a group of culinary historians who said, well, you know, we're looking here. There, not a lot of work was done in, I guess, curating. I think they were old menus at the New York Public Library. He said, because, you know, any writing about food was never considered academic enough. It was never really considered right. serious journalism. So I think that we've gotten over that, and yeah. hopefully we will continue to have, well, I mean, just look at the I would say glut, but I don't want to say glut. That's sort of derogatory. I want to say the flood of wonderful food books that are out there and the articles. And I just think the writing has continued to get better and better, and that we do appreciate good food journalism, and especially you. I'm so happy to have this book because it sheds such a bright light on what this is. And is it food journalism or is it culinary anthropology? I'd like to say it is both, and happily so. And Kimberly Voss, thank you so much for joining me for this half hour through culinary history. And I hope everyone, you will tune in again. I've been your host, Linda Palaccio, and this has been A Taste of the Past.
The theme song for A Taste of the Past is provided by Bohemia.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.